everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that would just like to say, man, I miss the days when we were taking a look at heart condition. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigeiser, and we continue to roll onwards in 2022, and we're getting back on our original gimmick with what is very much a road movie. But first things first, Dave, who are we and what are we doing with everybody's time this time?
Why, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, we throw it under the microscope, look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the film we discussed upon the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Oh, last time we were looking at the unsung hero of time-displaced rock and roll. We were looking at Eddie and the Cruisers, and from there we are following Luis Esposito, who, from an acting appearance in that one, 4 years into the future, where he was second assistant director on a film that is weirdly famous and yet nobody, I think, has actually seen. We are looking at the notorious 1987 film Ishtar, written and directed by Elaine May and starring Dustin Hoffman, Warren Beatty, Isabel Adjani, Charles Grodin, Jack Weston, Tess Harper, Carol Kane, Nat Frewer, and interesting note as well, shot by Vittorio Storaro, who is now a member of the Elite Multiple Appearance Club, if I'm not mistaken.
He is. I mean, we've covered him on Dominion, Little Buddha, The Conformist. He just, and I think he also shot, if I'm not mistaken, Francis Ford Coppola's One from the Heart, if I remember correctly, in which case...
I think you may be right. Again, we've looked at, like, one Robert De Niro film, and we have seen, like, five Vittorio Storaro and Mako films. That's the kind of show we are, and I love it. Hopefully people tuning in also love it. I don't know why you hate listen for 90-minute intervals. But, I mean, on the theme of spite, in some ways, as we'll get into, Ishtar at times seems like a film that came about as a result of spite. But I think if there is one thing that people our age or maybe younger, if they know anything about Ishtar, it's that the film certainly was synonymous for a point with a box office bomb. It is like, I didn't even really know what the film was about, but I knew enough that it was a movie because Gary Larson's Far Side has the famous Hell's Video Store, and it's nothing but copies of Ishtar. But, like, it ends up being kind of almost like a punchline film, the same way that Cutthroat Island is in the 1990s. But I genuinely wonder how many people have actually seen Cutthroat Island, and I do genuinely wonder how many people have seen Ishtar. Judging by the box office, not many at the time, but... Dave, what about you? What do you recall the first time you ever heard of the movie Ishtar?
Honestly, it was in the context of pretty much the exact thing we're talking about here. It was a punchline and a joke, but I didn't really know what it was, because even by the time I was a kid, it wasn't like I went looking for this movie. I just knew, yeah, Ishtar, apparently really terrible. Well, okay. And it wasn't till later on that I discovered it's like, oh, it's a Dustin Hoffman, Warren Beatty film. Oh, this thing was really expensive. Oh, it tanked like a rock at the box office and was critically reviled. Like, it was the punchline, as you noted here, for a long time. But what really drew me to this is that this film has actually been having, I don't want to say a full-on critically reevaluation recently, but a number of people have come back to it and said, you know what, it really wasn't that bad in this instance here. And we'll get into it, but no, it's that bad, folks. I don't care where this reevaluation's coming from.
Well, yeah. All that to say, though, prior to seeing it this time, had you ever seen Ishtar before?
No, this is my first time seeing Ishtar, and I can say, though, and confirm that Cutthroat Island is better than Ishtar.
Oh, wow. So, I haven't seen that, but now I can move it up my hierarchy that I keep on a list in my head so I don't have to use any paper. But yeah, it's weird though, because I think now we have another episode that we get to time and time again, infamously terrible films that again, end up being sort of underviewed for the amount of negativity that they get. So Dave's already tipped his hand. I might reserve my judgment, but there's probably most of you who, like us, even if you're not super film nerds, you haven't seen Ishtar. Maybe you don't remember The Far Side at all. What are you doing with your life? All that to say is now's the time we throw to Dave to bring us all up to speed by giving us the rundown.
Ishtar is the infamous 1987 comedy, written and directed by Elaine May and starring Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty, an update of the Bing Crosby and Bob Hope Road 2 movies. The film follows a pair of talentless New York singer-songwriters who take a gig in Marrakesh only to get caught up in the political turmoil in the fictional country of Ishtar thanks to a chance meeting at customs. A critical and commercial disaster upon release, the film's reputation in part stems from its notoriously difficult production and infighting between the filmmakers, resulting in a film which went excessively over budget. The film would derail the directorial career of May and help push Coca-Cola to sell Columbia Pictures, the studio behind the film, to Sony within a few years. Coming up after film strips, an episode of Zalman King's Cat People, the series, starring Audie England.
So, I guess the other thing is, the story that gets us to this film being made is doubly strange, I think, when you're a kid born when we were. Because if you were to tell me, like, when I was maybe like 12 years old, yeah, there's a movie with Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman, I would think of them first and foremost as, oh, they were both in Dick Tracy. And I would not know who Elaine May was. I still only have a fuzzy notion of who she is. But I mean, Dustin Hoffman is an actor that I appreciate greatly. The Graduate is one of my favorite movies. I think he's a very skilled dramatic and comedic actor. Warren Beatty is kind of a blind spot for me because I know he has a significant early career where he's not just an actor, but like, eventually becomes a producer and sort of like a power player for a while that I'm just completely blank on. Because I know Bonnie and Clyde, I know The Parallax View, and then I know Dick Tracy and Bullworth. So Dave, like, what's your take on Warren Beatty? Because I also don't think that we've looked at him on our show before.
We haven't, and here's the thing. Warren Beatty is very much, he is sort of, when we say film star, that is Warren Beatty more than fits that mold of what we mean by film star, in the sense that when you saw a Warren Beatty film, you were seeing a film, where Warren Beatty was front and center, and it was about his charisma and his power and his identity. And he comes of age and, sort of comes into his power during the sort of Hollywood Renaissance, when the old studio system has died off, and he's one of these young guns coming up
Well,
here,
yeah, because Bonnie and
but he.
Clyde, worth noting, is largely hailed as the first real film of what becomes the Hollywood Renaissance.
Absolutely. And he's in some ways at the forefront of really sort of merging what we can say as sort of classic or of sort of Hollywood production style with more quote unquote edgy source material. So, yes, things like the Parallax View, things like Shampoo, things that are more politically driven. And again, that's probably one of the big things about Beatty is that he was a very much a politically conscious film star as well, and ultimately producer. The thing about Beatty, though, is as we get into it here, is that he's also someone who's got sort of an outsized persona outside in his terms of his personal life as well,
Yeah, I
because
have
we're.
heard that there's a lot of people who do not get along with Warren Beatty, and I can see that, even though his the roles that he often plays are sort of the charming figure.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, he is very much the sort of definition of charmer, but also somebody who, in many ways, is remarkably, from my personal view of him, fairly unlikable. And the more stories that come out, and the more oblivious he seems, and just sort of, flippant he is. Like, I mean, putting aside his numerous famed romances throughout his life, including Madonna, his eventual wife Annette Bening, his co-star in this film, Isabelle Adjani, hopefully I'm not
Adiani.
mispronouncing her last name, Adiani, thank you. There again, Beatty has a long road here. He's had his infamous rivalry with Robert Redford, where they seem to be in competition for years.
I had no idea about that. Robert Redford is also kind of a blind spot for me, but that implies like I need to be authoritative on the life and times of Robert Redford. I don't know. It's just, yeah. But like at the same time, though, it definitely seems like even though I haven't seen the films, there certainly are enough critical and commercial successes to. I think I've used it before, but it's the Kanye West principle, where people and enterprises and institutions will put up with a great deal of things that you do, and they'll put up with a lot of your bad habits and less delightful qualities as long as you bring the hits and as long as you make money. And it's only once you stop being able to do that that everybody kind of shows you the door. Maybe that's why Warren Beatty works so infrequently these days. But, like, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, that's certainly one that is held in high regard. Reds, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's 81. And doesn't that win a bunch of Oscars?
It wins a bunch of Oscars. He directs that film in addition to starring it. And again, for those who haven't seen Reds, I mean, that's a film where when you sit there and say box office success and in terms of, you know, sort of critical success, that's not necessarily a film you would sit there and think that, yep, that's going to be the big, big smash one in this instance, because it's a film sort of about the Soviet revolution as it's taking place the October Revolution, please correct me here, as witnessed by Beatty's journalist character throughout that film. And I mean, you know, it's a very, you know, it was an expensive film. A lot of people were assuming it was gonna bomb, but it comes out and Beatty defies the odds and makes a huge hit out of it when that happens there. And certainly going on there, that gives him a lot of power in this instance here. And again, as somebody who likes to throw that power around, he ends up deciding that one of the things he wants to do is, quote unquote, do a favor for somebody in this instance.
Yes, because Elaine May also, apparently she contributed to the script on Heaven Can Wait, and I don't know, is she credited or uncredited with the script on Reds?
I'm honestly not 100% certain if she's accredited or uncredited on
But she definitely worked on the screenplay for that film as well. And, you know, it makes sense where, hey, you've collaborated on two of my biggest recent hits. I've also won Academy Awards now. Let's give you the reins. Which is both kind and very patronizing at the same time.
Well, yeah, there is a patronizing side, and the fact that Beatty sort of perceived this as I'm going to be giving doing her a solid in this instance, really sort of emphasized that. She was also famously for a time married or involved in a relationship with Mike Nichols. Yeah, there.
Yes, director of Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate.
Exactly, and eventual director of Wolf and Catch 22 as well. But she would go on to herself to have a very successful directing career, starting with The Heartbreak Kid in 1972, a film which she didn't write, but she directed starring Charles Grodin, which was a big hit, and then later remade into an infamous critical and commercial bomb by Ben Stiller. Who could have been shocked by that? She would also go on to write and direct and co-star in a Peter Falk, John Cassavetes film, Mikey and Nikki, which I have not seen, but I really do want to see.
Want to see that now. She also did the script for The Birdcage later, I believe.
Yes. Yes, she did, and Primary Colors, the Bill Clinton film starring John Travolta there. Point is, she's had a long and interesting career, and she was one of the few women filmmakers to sort of make some inroads into Hollywood, and supposedly Beatty decided, I will assist her, quote-unquote, or gift her this doing a film where she will have more creative control than she's ever had in this instance. And what she comes up with there is she basically has this idea of wanting to update the Road to movies. Now, if you're not familiar with those, these were a series of films starring Bing Crosby and Bob Hope, which effectively were always about putting these two as sort of a comedic duo in situations where they would have to be on the road to somewhere. And usually it was into different countries where their humor and comedy would ostensibly develop from the sort of culture clash which happens. Now, if you're sitting here saying, that sounds like a risk where there's potentially going to be a lot of racist tropes and uncomfortable, problematic material there, you would be right. But
well, you can also point to The In-Laws, which we saw recently. Also, another Peter Falk moment with Alan Arkin. And conceptually, that's more or less what we're getting here. And that's more or less what you get from the Road films. But that's also a film that, I mean, it's sort of the difference of who your target is, right? You know, it's very easy to go the lazy route where it's just, look at how wacky these foreigners are. Whereas The In-Laws, you know, certainly lampoons sort of the mindset of the Banana Republic without necessarily being like a racist film. I know that we are going to talk about this further as we get into Ishtar. But well, yeah, it's kind of dicey territory, the same way that you can't. Like, comedy has to renew itself, because for all people complain about, you know, oh, people are trying to cancel comedians, or they won't let people be funny anymore. It's like, you gotta remember that, like, there's a reason that people don't do vaudeville routines on stage either. It's not just because, you know, certain terms or subjects become less okay to joke about, but also, it's like, you have to reinvent things, you know? When's the last time you saw a really good prop comedian, you know?
Well, exactly. Now, the big thing here is, although I would like to note that Mystery Science Theater 3000 still occasionally pulls out a bit of prop comedy, it does it pretty well. But putting that aside in this instance here, the big thing here is, I'm not going to sit there and say you can't update the Road movies. There's certainly a path to doing it. And really, when you get right down to...
Look at the In-Laws. They kind of update the Road movie, except there's no singing and dancing. Well, and it seems that the real difference May wants to put in here is, I guess the hilarious innovation is that, our guys are going to be singers, musicians, but they're not going to be good at it.
Well, okay. And again, there is something to be said for comedies built around people who are convinced they have talent, but don't really in this instance. It's a tough trick to pull off if you don't do it well, but it is entirely possible to do this in this world. I mean, even things to greater or lesser extents. I mean, Tenacious D to some extent is the whole notion of the band is built around the idea that these two guys are utterly convinced that they are far greater than they actually are as rock and rollers.
But it's that belief that makes them great. Well, I mean, I'm not 14 anymore, so I don't really care about them, but I get what you're saying.
Exactly. And I mean, the thing is that Tenacious D also, at least, I mean, Jack Black and, why am I blanking on his
name? Kyle Gass.
Thank you very much. I mean, they were our talented, you know, writers and comedians themselves. So they had something to go with here. Now, May, who doesn't, I mean, she wants to do this, and her whole idea is, yes, basically a series of lousy songwriters and performers basically end up going to a Middle Eastern nation, a fictional one in this instance, and end up getting caught in between sort of a... liberation group and the Central Intelligence Agency in terms of the shenanigans, and basically have no clues to what they actually find themselves in over their head. Again, there's room for this. There are plenty of great comedies, particularly about the corruption at the CIA that were made during the 80s. Watch Hopscotch starring Walter Matthau, folks. That one is a delight. It definitely does that extremely well. Arguably, once again, yes, The In-Laws does that as well, even if it's a bit more gentle poking at the Central Intelligence Agency more than anything else. But the big idea here is, okay, she wants to do this, she wants to get going, but she also has a couple things that she wants to do in this instance here. First of all, she wants to end up casting Warren Beatty against type. So where he would be the bumbling member of the duo in this instance, and was hoping to get Dustin Hoffman to play the very confident member of the group in this instance.
I guess she was thinking, like, man, imagine if there were more yucks in Midnight Cowboy.
Well, and this is the thing. Hoffman is legitimately a potentially talented comedic
But it's comedic the same performer. Dynamic. Smooth-talking Dustin Hoffman and a big, big wet-behind-the-ears Texan, right?
Well, yes, and we'll get into some of this as we get into the film proper about the degree of success she has with this casting. I have some questions, but okay, I mean, this is the thing. But here, well, right off the bat, here's the big thing I will say about this. When I think of Dustin Hoffman and I think of Warren Beatty, the first place I don't go is necessarily them as, you know, big comedic stars in this instance. They have been in good comedies, but I don't innately say, yep, that's the comedy duo I want to go and see.
Well, right, you look there at Dustin Hoffman and like his strengths really are his stoic demeanor. Or like even in The Graduate, like so much of the humor is him being the terrified straight man while big personalities are playing off of him, as opposed to being like the leading comic force in a movie.
Exactly here. And Warren Beatty, again, he can be funny. But one thing I'm going to say right up front here is there are many things Warren Beatty is very good at. Making himself the butt of a joke is not one of those things. And we will get into this as we get into the movie. But the point is, okay, she secures Beatty. Beatty's going to be the producer and promises that he's going to basically back her throughout this whole film. It takes
for about 3 days of shooting.
Yeah. She wants to get Dustin Hoffman involved, and he's hesitant, but eventually is persuaded there.
Yeah, because he also hadn't acted for some time prior to this, right? Because he does Tootsie, and then doesn't he do stage for a couple years?
Something like that. I know he takes a little bit of a break there at that time. But also along this, we also have Columbia Pictures, who at this point is headed up by a man by the name of Guy McElwain here. Now, he was apparently a little bit concerned about this whole project, mostly because his understanding was that Elaine May loves to shoot a ton of film and is a perfectionist there. And she's not alone. There are many filmmakers with that reputation. David Fincher is long known for shooting excessive takes. Stanley Kubrick, on every film he ever seemed to do, was known for his obsessive, endless perfectionist takes. So she is hardly alone in this. But again, I mean, it gives him pause because the more takes you shoot, the slower you go, the more expensive your film's going to be there. But basically, and he's also apparently concerned because, well, you have May, Beatty, and Hoffman in this instance. Apparently, all three of them had that exact same issue where they were perfectionists. They want to get it right and they don't want to, you know, move on if it's not 100% there. But effectively, he was looking at this and agreed to fund it because who's going to be the person that passes on a project that has Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman at the height of their powers and a critically acclaimed director in Elaine May?
Well, I think it also helps that I've seen it reported that Hoffman and Beatty were both paid about $5 million each, which for inflation is closer to $10 million. And I guess the three of them together cost about $13 million of the originally approved $27.5 million. If you think about it that way, I mean, $5 million is probably enough to cover most of your misgivings about signing on to a project, especially in 1987, and especially for a comedy. If you're not Eddie Murphy, like, you don't really see that kind of paycheck at the time.
Well, exactly there. And again, let's not forget, within a few years prior to this, Columbia Pictures had also greenlit an extraordinarily expensive comedy starring a group of very high-profile talents by the name of Ghostbusters. So I don't think anybody involved in this one was expecting this was going to be a Ghostbusters-level hit. But even then, Columbia wasn't expecting Ghostbusters to be a Ghostbusters-level hit. Please see the Reitman for the Job episodes for more details on the production history of that film in this instance. But yeah, I mean, it's like, okay, there's no reason not to assume that this can't be successful. They bring in an A-list cinematographer in the form of Vittorio Storaro here. Yeah. They end up getting
and
some...
And even better, there's a cheap way for them to actually film all the desert scenes. Because through various legal agreements, one of... Is it Coca-Cola, I think, that... owned Colombia at the time, had assets in Morocco, and they couldn't unload them, so they figured that as a cost-saving measure, we can actually fly you out to Morocco and film on location in the Sahara Desert, which proved to be a little bit of a problem when active combat broke out between Israel and the PLO.
When you sit there and you think that there isn't going to be a film production that's remotely as chaotic as Apocalypse Now, and then your light comedy that's an update of the Road movies ends up being like that, problems have ensued here. But what makes it all the funnier is that the idea was like, well, we can shoot close to LA and just use some of the deserts in America. It'll be much smoother. And then they realize it's like, well, we can shoot in Morocco so cheap. And then it turns out, no, that was going to backfire actively on him. But on top of which, they also bring in Paul Williams. Yes, the Paul Williams here to write music for, or to write the songs in this film. And let me tell you, that's a hell of a grab in this instance here. And he ends up writing a series of full-on songs for this film, even though we basically only end up hearing one of them by the end of it here. And even though, yes, the songs that he's asked to write are, by design, supposed to be terrible.
Which is a challenge, because you can't make something that's absolute garbage. You know, it's like we were talking about with Eddie and the Cruisers, where the music has to be right for the film. And here, it's like, it's that difficult balance of sincere ineptitude. But full credit, I think the songs actually pull it off. This is what an unskilled songwriter trying their best would come up with. And when you're a professional songwriter, that's probably harder to do.
Well, exactly. So, basically, they go in to start shooting this movie, and basically, yeah, within 3 days, everything had gone to hell. Yeah. Basically, Ellen May and Warren Beatty were at each other's throats very quickly. Yes, the PLO and Israel start getting into conflict here, which destabilizes the region. It turns out that when you decide to shoot in a country like Morocco that doesn't necessarily have a film infrastructure that's built up quite so easily there, you end up having to import a lot more technology and crew than you necessarily anticipated at first.
There's very few on-site resources, also unfamiliarity with the conditions, but like there are so many little stories about just inefficiencies, or not even like the system run amok or anything, but just like unforced errors where, you know, a big argument broke out between May, Beatty, and Storaro over camera placement, and then they decide that they would film at a different site, and it took them 10 days to find something they deemed suitable. And, like, you're wandering around the middle of a desert, man. What are you doing, and why are you doing all of this for the film that we ultimately get? It ends up getting to the point where the film, I'm not sure how far above schedule it goes, but for a film that was greenlit for $27.5 million, it ends up coming out costing closer to $50. And then there's also this weird sort of apocrypha surrounding the film over whether the execs at Columbia tanked it on purpose to teach them all a lesson, and like inflating the movie more and more with a view to watching it blow up.
I have some questions about that, because I mean, the short version of that side of it that people need to know is that ultimately the CEO of Columbia at this point ultimately ends up firing McElwain, the production head who ended up greenlighting this movie, and ends up putting in charge David Putnam, somebody who really had a problem with the budgetary excesses in Hollywood that were running amok throughout the 1970s, and really did not get along with Warren Beatty here. In this instance. But basically, while this is going on, they pretty much, because nobody wants is really running the ship tightly on this one, or is willing to call the shots, Beatty doesn't want to, even though he's really dismissive of May later on, you know, through this gift he quote-unquote gave her, he doesn't want to get her fired because, as far as he's concerned, that'll be bad for his public image in this instance. Columbia doesn't necessarily want to admit that things have gone so completely south on this one, although the rumors are that Putnam apparently started leaking information to the press about what a debacle the whole thing was turning out to, because this thing ultimately ends up costing $50 million plus just to market. And Columbia ultimately
and that's
does...
insane. Especially when you think about, like, Catch-22 was seen as way too expensive for the film they got, and there's at least, like, war scenes in that. There is very little in terms of scope or scale within this film that evinces why it costs $50 million, nor is there anything in the concept of a film that should have gotten anywhere close to that point.
Yeah, exactly. And ultimately, I mean, the reason I find it hard to believe that Columbia deliberately tanked this film to teach him a lesson is only because so much money was spent on this thing. And again, they did market the hell out of this. They gave it a push because they had no choice but to do so in this instance. But this film ultimately, like, by the time it comes out, the press is ready to kill it. Critics are not impressed at all.
It's kind of dead on arrival by that point. And it's not helped by the fact that apparently there was like 120 hours of rush footage. And I mean, the film that we end up getting, I think there's a director's cut of it now, but it's about an hour and 50. And when you think about it, it's like, how much extra footage did you need? How many different takes did you need of what we get? You know, it's just like, it really does seem like a case where everybody had their own idea, but they all talked themselves out of saying no to somebody about something important. And yeah, like, the film already has a reputation in the press. A lot of conflicts that Beatty has had with the press kind of get... Maybe an opportunity for a little payback there. But basically, it kind of seems like everybody made their minds up, right? And when you have the whole press against a film, it's no wonder that when it comes out, it is savaged by most of them and largely ignored by audiences. It ends up making, I think, 15 at the box office. And... you know, the weird thing is, for all we talk about, like, this is, you know, this is a flop. There are some movies that flop so hard they bankrupt a studio, or they cause a dramatic shift in the way the industry as a whole approaches its business practices, or sort of how it conceives of the ideal film object. If anything, this is a film that flopped pretty hard, but really the only damage that occurred was localized on Elaine May's career.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, yeah, of all the people who take the brunt of it, I won't say unfairly that she takes some of the blame here, but the degree to which she's the one that gets sidelined is absolutely unfair, because this should have impacted Warren Beatty. This should have impacted Dustin Hoffman. Like, the blame should have been shared fairly amongst all three, and instead she's the one that gets hammered in that instance. And that is completely unfair, unquestionably, in this instance.
Well, see, and you were just nodding to it, though, Dave, where it's like, you can sort of acknowledge that, but it also beckons you to look at the film itself. And, you know, this is probably a film where we'll talk sort of issues peripheral to it than necessarily the strict linear plot description, because it's a pretty thin and simple film, despite the amount of tinkering that they clearly went at for a long time. But yeah, you have to watch the movie, and it's like, it is not a case where, like, Elaine May has put together a wonderful performance, or a wonderful composition that the actors are sandbagging, right? It's not that the actors are hilarious, and it's just, it's poorly edited. It's just... the way this film goes wrong and fails to perform, arguably fails to launch in the first place, like, all the issues of the film are intertwined. And I guess having seen it, it really does make the most sense to think about Ishtar both as a nightmare production and as a middling object as really kind of everybody's fault at the same time. And again, all it took was one person saying no on one thing or one juncture, and I think you would end up with a much better film.
Well, I think this is the thing. Like, more than any film we've taken a look at, this is a case of ego being the big, big problem in all these cases. And we have at least three or four big egos in the mix on this film, duking it out. And again, this is the kind of failure that can only exist because of the Hollywood system itself, in this instance, and because of what the Hollywood system had become in terms of the star system by the 1980s, where they have the power in this instance. And there really isn't much that the studio heads per se, I mean, not that they're powerless in this instance here, but because they have to play ball with those egos in a way that would not have happened during the classic Hollywood era, in this instance. That
well, also, really... when you have Coca-Cola owning film studios, you know, in terms of the length of time and size of bills that they can pay on a production, you know, it's like a war of attrition that they can hold out a long time before they realize something has clearly gone wrong.
Well, absolutely here. And coming back to, I mean, and to get into the film proper at this point, the thing is that with, you know, there are films we can look back and say, okay, this was a bomb or it didn't work. But things, you know, there are elements that you can sit there and say, oh, this was good. Or, you know, divorced from the context of the times, you can see why this is much better than its reputation was. Like, you look back at things like, you know, Batman Returns, which was not well received at the time in 1992. Most people are able to look at it and say, yeah, you take it out of the context of what the expectations were in 92. This film, you know, is vastly better than it's given credit for. Or something like David Lynch's Dune, where even if you don't like the final result, A, you're wrong, but B, the point of the matter here is that, I mean, I think most people would still be willing to walk away and say, there is nothing quite like it out there. And
well, with all those films, it's regardless of the overall viewing experience, there are certainly elements to appreciate looking back at them in the present. And
yeah,
you know, unfortunately, it's not really a case where it's like, well, it's, you know, like we saw with Josie and the Pussycats, where it's like, no, this is actually a much more clever film than any of the critics could even possibly conceive of a film that is based off an Archie comic. Like, it's just, there's no capacity to recognize that a film adapted from this source material can do the things that it's doing. That's not what we get here, because in many ways, you know, it's not an updating of the Hope and Crosby formula as much as it seems to be a throwback to it. And I guess the question is why? Because Hoffman and Beatty can certainly be funny and they do have reasonably good chemistry together, but they are not Hope and Crosby. And it's just like, yeah, there's something very purposeless at the heart of this film, where given the lengths that it took to get here, given all the egos involved, given everybody's absolute insistence on perfection, I still can't quite connect that to the pretty thin film that this ultimately is, and how stock it all kind of feels. But, I mean, to begin, our main characters, and like, it's the kind of film where you have to remind yourself at times, oh yeah, this is a comedy, without it ever really getting serious. But our main characters are Chuck and Lyle. Chuck played by Dustin Hoffman, Lyle by Warren Beatty, and through various montages, we see them as hard luck, inept, but very hardworking songwriters. And funny enough, the first 15 minutes is probably the best material in this film, because it's not quite Taxi Driver in its presentation, but like, it's an interesting montage of shots of them working out lyrics together, and as purposely terrible as this song is, it will get stuck in your head for a long while. And it's just shots of them, like, arguing with each other, trying to finish rhymes, and eventually performing on stage, all while they're also banging at the piano about how telling the truth can be a dangerous business.
Yeah.
And like, it's that kind of lounge act type material. And again, like, it's not that this scene is particularly funny, but there's an interesting fluidity to how it's edited. And it sets up the expectation that the rest of the film is going to be like it, and it's not.
Well, and this is where we get into the first problem. So let's start, I think, with probably my... The big way this plays out is that ultimately they end up trying to get an agent in this instance. And the agent they end up turning to in this instance is Marty Freed, played by Jack Weston, who then informs them that it's like, okay, you know, clearly just trying to brush them off that they need, you know, like a gimmick unlike others, which they then try in this instance. It doesn't work. He realizes that it's even more terrible now that they followed his advice. But he does say that he can get them a booking in Morocco at a hotel in this instance here. So, okay, fair enough. That'll be fine. Because
the previous act who was playing there dropped out due to security concerns as the region is going through major political upheaval.
Yeah, and the big thing is that they are left to think about this. They both go into a bar, even though in this instance, Chuck wants to be left alone to think about it. And then Warren Beatty's Lyle wanders into the bar because it's, like, as he notes, the only bar that's open at night, and starts chatting to the bartender. And this leads to an extended montage of how these two met and how their partnership sort of formed and became, and the impact that it's had on their life.
And this sequence as well continues very much like the very smooth edits with a lot of audio bridges. Sort of linking space and time. It's not to say that it's new wave, but it's certainly maybe the most interesting aspect of the film, again, because, you know, it's especially its placement as well, how we meet the guys and then bit by bit, we go a little forward and then we're given the story about how 5 months ago they ended up meeting by chance and agreeing to become songwriters together. And both of them end up getting dumped. All of it culminates in a weirdly extended scene of Chuck climbing out the ledge of his apartment after his girlfriend leaves him. And police are summoned. All that leads up to Lyle being the one who goes out on the ledge to calm him down. And since then, they've been words and music, linked fingers. Oh, wait, that was last week's film. And then, you know, sort of all that. We return to the bar, and then Chuck more or less agrees, okay, we'll do it. We'll go seek fame and fortune in Morocco. And, you know, it plays very much like... you know, your sort of Kramer versus Kramer type film. Not quite social realism, but like, not really a comedy. Really just married couples talking about issues while they walk around New York. It feels very Woody Allen-esque, and not just because Dustin Hoffman's girlfriend was one of the wives in Annie Hall.
Well, and here's the thing here. That's really... my big issue with this. Everything with Dustin Hoffman is pretty good because Hoffman gets the tone he's going for and he knows the shtick he's going for.
Yeah. And there's a scene of him performing an anniversary song for an elderly couple where just as earnestly and heartfelt as possible, he sings a song about I'm leaving my love in the will. And like, it's kind of an obvious joke, but it works better than you would think it does.
Well, absolutely.
And it especially is capped off well by angry Dustin Hoffman afterwards. Oh, I shouldn't have played that. No, they loved it. If they loved it, why did they start booing and throwing food at me?
Yeah. The problem is that Warren Beatty just... he does not work in this movie, and for a whole variety of reasons. Because, I mean, here's the problem.
Works with Hoffman just fine. He does not work in his solo scenes. He does not have any chemistry with Isabel Adjani, who presumably is only in the film because she was his partner at the time. Like, he just feels so unmoored from this film.
Well, part of the problem is a couple things. Like, part of the problem is that Warren Beatty like I said, he's a charmer, he's a big ego, and he's the guy who has to be noticed in the room. That's part of his thing. Asking him to play a soft-spoken, dim-witted doofus, who's an ice cream man by trade, who doesn't even notice that kids are chasing after him because he's so busy composing lyrics. No, that is not Warren Beatty. Like, he can't play that. That is not something he's capable. It's about as successful as Tom Cruise playing your average New York dock worker in The War of the Worlds with his perfectly capped teeth and, you know, muscle car that he has. Like, it's just awful in this instance. And again, he is totally checked out in this movie. And anytime he's asked to play this sort of goofiness, like, it feels like somebody who's trying to imitate what he thinks bad work is, as opposed to actually being able to do a bad job while still giving the absolute and utter conviction to it. So, yeah,
well, it, because I mean, there are stories about, like, you know, in the early SNL days, like, Belushi would sandbag a lot of the sketches written by women and things because he didn't think women can be funny. That's not what's happening here. Like, you get the sense that Beatty's, he is giving it for this performance, but just none of it is working.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, it just, it does not work. And they should have realized early on that enough that this was a mistake. But the problem is, when Beatty's your producer on the film as well, what are you going to do? Fire him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, but the problem is that the rest of the film gets weighted down by him in this instance. Because, I mean, at least while Hoffman is trying to make stuff worth, in this instance, Beatty is just dead weight the entire time we're going through. And this is only going to get emphasized the further we get on and we realize how much better most of the supporting cast is from anybody who's working in the
And I don't think it's a coincidence that most of the supporting cast get their best scenes, and sometimes the only scenes, with Chuck as opposed to Lyle. But yeah, so they end up flying to Morocco, though, and, you know, shortly thereafter, they, a mysterious woman who we later know is Shira, played by Adyani, bumps into Chuck at the airport, very quickly explains the situation. I think we also get the cut to, like, Raiders of the Lost Ark tier. We found a map that will change everything.
Yeah, because her brother, along with another archaeologist, finds this map that apparently has something to do with the overthrow of a corrupt government in Ishtar. Like, I mean, this is the thing. Like, yeah, it never even...
It's a functional MacGuffin that ends up becoming weirdly emphasized the more and more this film approaches its end. Because then at that point, it very much is a question of politics in ways that the rest of the film isn't.
Well, yes, and there's also her, when we get Shira appearing in her first scene, the running gag in this film is that she's apparently always being mistaken for a young boy, starting with Chuck here. And at no point does this gag either A, funny, or B, ever register as something that anybody would buy into.
And it, like, doesn't pay off into anything either.
Yeah, like, literally the closest thing it has to a payoff is her having to flash Chuck very quickly while he's trying to go through customs to ask for his passport and other stuff in order to get through.
Like, it would be one thing if, like, the recurring gag is everybody thinks that she's a man, and then at the end they're using, or they're counting on that to disguise themselves, and, like, the big bad is like, no, that is clearly and obviously a woman. What's wrong with you? You know, that can work. This just happens a few times and then stops. And it's even worse because, like, we get, like, a really lengthy, unfunny bit of Warren Beatty, like, trying to act befuddled and sincerely believes that he just kissed Isabel Adyani and believes that it's a young boy. But all that to say is he gives her the passport, and then very, very quickly makes the acquaintance of the real secret weapon of the film, and that's when we're introduced to Charles Grodin, joining us from Catch 22, also directed by Mike Nichols. Everybody knows each other. But here we get the very friendly American Jim Harrison, who happens to bump into Chuck in the lobby. They agree to go for a drink, and very casually, they're talking about business. And it's, what do you do? Well, I'm a lounge singer. I'm here to play in Morocco. What about you? I'm a CIA agent. And I love Hoffman's response where he says, huh, is that interesting work?
Well, exactly. And this is the thing where, because the thing is that because he gave up his passport, Lyles had to go on to Morocco without him to try and salvage their job, because it's going to take him much longer to get his passport, seemingly. And in this instance, Harrison is basically pitching, it's like, look, here's what's going on here. You know, we like to pay people occasionally just to keep an ear out, look out for things. We can push through your passport much
quicker,
Yeah.
Quicker. And I like how Grodin blends, you know, sort of like the official bureaucratic speak with also just clearly tipping what they're doing, where it's very
Yeah.
much that like salesman-esque, like, all we're saying is that if you're traveling abroad and you keep your eyes and ears open, the State Department will happily be willing to offer you a modest retainer where we pay you $150 a week. And you know, Charles Grodin is a strong comic performer, and
Yes.
he is probably the best cast person in this film.
He's the only like one that 100% understands the role he's playing, what his function is in this movie. And it's the only thing where any sort of satire in this movie works, where we realize it's the CIA's increasingly inept attempts to control what's going on in this region and just failing miserably, not just because they entrust it to ultimately these two fools, but because they completely underestimate or overestimate their own abilities to control the situation at any given point in time.
Yeah,
And it
it comes off, it's less the Expendables and more, you know, the diplomacy scenes in Hunt for Red October.
Exactly. And I mean, Grodin is such a great, you know, middle management bureaucrat throughout every scene in this movie. Like,
Yeah,
that's the
because like
one thing that
actually,
works.
to that point, it works because he is middle management. One of the funniest
Yeah.
scenes in the film is him juggling three phones and alternating between being incredibly aggressive with his underlings and being incredibly subservient with his supervisors.
Yeah, exactly. So the big justification for the plot here, and the big thing is that basically the current regime that's in control here does not want this map to appear, because then it will get the people apparently believing in this prophecy about two men who will show up and lead to an overthrow of the government. Gee, I wonder where this is going.
Yeah, but it's curiously unstressed to the point where like they'll
You
go
can
enough
forget
time without mentioning
it.
the nominal plot or the importance of the map. I forgot by the end of the film like what the map is supposed to achieve, only that it's important. And that's kind of the level of interest in theme that the film has running through it.
Well, absolutely, because ultimately what this comes down to is just a case of endless, you know, mistaken identities or misunderstandings, where suddenly, you know, Shira decides to go after Lyle because she somehow finds out that Chuck is quote unquote a CIA plant, which he is, even though he doesn't fully understand that himself here, and Lyle not fully understanding and then starting to lead to a distrust of Chuck. Chuck being displeased because he thinks that Lyle is a communist agent because he's been told so by the CIA, which, you know, ticks him off mostly, as we'll eventually find it. One of the few gags that works with in this movie is he wonders why Shira didn't approach him to become
Yes.
his communist agent or
It's
her
like, what?
communist
I'm
agent.
not good enough to be a sleeper agent for you. You had to pick him. It's,
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know, like, and that's the thing. There's a lot of scenes that are structured, not like vignette style, but like the scenes are fairly straightforward, where most of them follow like character is out walking in this situation. And they talk to this one character, and that's all the scene. Like they don't really play out extensively, and they don't ever get any more complicated than that.
Well, and part of the problem here is that at a certain point, I just don't
Just saying
care about
that
Chuck and
to the
Lyle.
end that it, well, yeah, it all feels very interchangeable, where like the order of events isn't terribly crucial. You have the comedy of misunderstandings, and then you just have gags for a while of the guys misunderstanding, the plan or what they're trying to do. And then every so often it's interspersed with shots of various intelligence agents trying to kill them. And like, that's the thing. It's not that this film is bad in the sense that it's like tasteless or just goes completely off the rails nuts or anything like that. It's just not very interesting. And with a film that is an hour and 50 minutes long that ended up costing more than twice what they planned on, you want it to do more than occasionally make you go every 15 or 20 minutes.
Well, and what really this film reminds me of is of an even less structured and interesting version of Deal of the Century, the William Friedkin directed Chevy Chase Gregory Hines movie, which, if you might remember, we didn't cover on the show, but I made very clear when we talked about the other William Friedkin comedy, The Brinks Job. I thought Deal of a Century was awful, and it is awful, but there's more structure and more coherence, and it's shorter than this bloody film is. Like, this thing is overlong by a long stretch. Like, this thing could be cut down by 30 minutes, and you would miss nothing.
Well, it's even
Absolutely
more
nothing.
jarring because the first 15 minutes or so is actually interesting in terms of its editing, in terms of its cinematography and like visual composition. And then that very quickly gives way to just watching everybody at times literally spin their wheels in a monochrome desert. And at that point, Vittorio Storaro is a great cinematographer, but the way that, they're staging scenes and the time of day they're shooting at, like, they don't have vistas. They're finding a patch of flat ground they could all agree on after a 10-day argument. And so, like, none of it rises to the level of visual splendor that I feel they were kind of hoping to capture. So if it's
Well,
not funny, if it's not interesting, and it's not even all that visually arresting, it's like, why is this film so long? Do you know the band Wilco?
I can't. I've heard of Wilco, but I actually haven't. Not that I know of offhand, have I listened to
Well,
them.
that's okay. I mean, they're kind of like the anti-Elaine May in a sense, where they had the one record where they made it really personal, really of its time. Great album, by the way, but they submitted it to Warner Records, and Warner said, "No, we don't hear a single. We're not going to do that." So they released them from the record deal. Wilco found another. It was a company owned by Warner, weirdly enough. They put out the album and on its release was hailed as like the first great, truly great American album of the post 2000 years. But like at the same time, there was a documentary about it, I Am Trying to Break Your Heart, which is a good watch and well shot, but there are many scenes where the band members are just quibbling about every minor detail and talking about timing cues and when to start fading out a track and getting to the point where they give each other migraines and have to run off to the bathroom to vomit. And it's like, well, you look at that and it's like, your record is very good. And it's great to make a very good record. I don't know if you need to put yourself through this level of micromanagement and personal suffering to produce what you're ultimately producing. Because there is a version of Ishtar where they got this filmed in 6 weeks, they did it for $10 million, it made back 15, and that was fine. And that's not what we get here, and I don't understand why. I don't understand what the vision was, what they were aiming to do that got so many people so invested and so much capital invested in it either. Because there is just a fundamental blandness at the heart of it. Like Apocalypse Now, even if it failed horribly, you could at least be like, that was a failure of ambition. Here it's a failure of scope and management, but there's no real ambition to this movie.
Well, I think part of the problem is if you look at what Elaine May had made up to this point, she made basically smaller character-based comedies and dramas at this point in time. And this is supposed to be a big, large-scale, widescreen adventure romp with music and slapstick gags and big,
Yeah, like
visual vistas.
Sahara was.
Well, but I mean, but that's the thing where, you know, she's not that kind of filmmaker by this point in time. And again, to take this on after making the, like, this is the equivalent of, like, say, giving the guy who made Chronicle, you know, a film made for $8 million. Oh, here, now go ahead and make the $150 million Fantastic Four reboot at this point in time. You're literally setting yourself up in this instance.
I mean, recently looked at Spike Lee's Inside Man. And, you know, one thing that we certainly talked about is how on paper, it really does not seem like a Spike Lee kind of film or kind of production, except that's an instance where it works really well. And I think it's precisely sort of like that outside eye coming to a different genre or style, you know, can lead to really innovative results. None of that happens here. Instead, it just sort of betrays the fact that nobody on screen or behind the camera was familiar with what they were trying to do.
Well, and I think that to come back to your Spike Lee example with Inside Man, there are two other big things that make the difference. One, in terms of Inside Man here, you know, Spike Lee is still making a film set in New York. And if there's one thing that Spike Lee knows, it's New York City in this instance there. Whereas we have Elaine May here, who's making a film where, notably, the stuff that works is mostly set in New York in the opening 20 minutes. The minute she gets out of that city and suddenly is in a completely different country, the only thing that she can rely back on is a bunch of racist stereotypes that were dated by 1987 when this film came out. And that's the thing. She does not understand what is going on in different African nations here, or the Middle East, or what's going on in Morocco. Like, there's nothing that that indicates that she has any understanding of beyond the basic signifiers that Hollywood had been trotting out for decades.
Yeah, by like this Gambit, for comparison's sake, that is a film that is both aware of cultural stereotypes and, like, very clever in its sort of subverting and reworking of them. That comes out 20 years before Ishtar does.
Yeah.
So, again, there's just something that feels very stock and obvious, and maybe it's trying to just replicate the Hope and Crosby kind of vibe. But again, it's like, why? Because if the only goal of this is sort of like that nostalgic evocation of, you know, films that clearly a lot of people were very influenced by in their youth, it's like, well, you're not going to recapture that because Hope and Crosby are dead. And, you know, it's like all you're really doing in trying to make an ode to that is highlighting, again, why comedy needs to reinvent itself. Because otherwise it just kind of comes off as pastiche. But I mean, a whole lot of nothing really important happens. We get a few light chase scenes. We get a few, like, further romantic misunderstandings. We get a few more scenes of Chuck and Lyle both trying to spy on one another as both of them become further embroiled into communism and government consultancy. All of this leads up, though, to, I forget what even motivates it, but eventually the ruler of Ishtar, you know, the incumbent, you know, the brutal dictator who the CIA is propping up, though, he basically indicates that the map is a threat, he needs to clean house, and he insists that the Americans who know about it are liquidated, which Harrison is forced to comply with. Meanwhile, though, Shira and the other communists, for whatever reason, decide that Chuck and Lyle have to die as well. So both sides send the two men out into the desert with a blind camel for a really long stretch of the film that goes nowhere.
Yeah. It is brutal. Not only in that, that's the thing. Like, yeah, we bought a blind camel, and apparently we're just supposed to find that that's a funny gag in and of itself. You
well,
do because
it's the password that Lyle was supposed to use to identify, yes. But he thinks it's literal. So he figures if he buys a blind camel, something fun's gonna happen. I do the one sort of reversal, though, where the vendor basically just looks at him, blinks a few times, and is like, "You want a blind camel? Well, Here's a blind camel. We also have one that has a sore leg. I have another dead camel as well. And I mean, yeah. Like, that's sort of where the film kind of lands on the safe side of the line, because, you know, it's like the Naked Gun joke, right? Where Drebin needs a taxi, so he tries to run into one. The driver's screaming a foreign language at him. Runs into another. Driver screaming a foreign language. Runs into a third, sees it's a guy wearing traditional African garb, and he says, "Never mind." As he runs off, the driver says, in perfect clear accent, "I wonder what the devil he wanted."
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Like, that is sort of, I think, kind of the barometer there, where if your joke is any further directed towards, you know, difference or marginalized identities, then it's probably not okay. If as long as, though, white people are the butt of the joke, I don't have a problem with it. We've had it too good for too long.
Well, but this is the problem. The further the film goes on, the more racist stereotypes it engages in, and the more very unfunny, problematic humor comes up. Because eventually, yes, they wander in the desert, they're trying to get set up for the kill. Somehow this involves them running into a gun sales, or gun sellers and gun runners in this instance, where they think that Chuck in this instance is the translator in this instance. And this builds to a gag where, like, he starts...
From them going into the desert to the conclusion of this scene, it's like 15 minutes, maybe more, and it feels like about 3 hours.
Yeah, it is absolutely miserable. But it comes to this, and suddenly the big quote-unquote innovative gags that are highly overpaid writer, director, and stars, and producer in this instance, come up with is Dustin Hoffman shrieking nonsense and occasionally throwing in the name of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and screaming it like that's a language in this instance, while people look around confused in this instance.
And again, it's like... It kind of works, because, you know, the logic is that nobody actually understands what this crazy guy is screaming at them in no language, but because Lyle's in the crowd, he's able to pantomime to make it simulate that he's actually interpreting. But again, it's like, okay, that's not enough to make it funny on its own, though. There's a lot of the delivery, and it just comes off as flat, and again, like, just very low energy, just very much like, well, this is what we got.
Well, and more to the point, this then leads to an effort when the CIA are flying a helicopter overhead, realize that they're not dead and that they've interrupted this gun-selling thing, which ends up leading to a... extraordinarily poorly staged shootout and firefight that's going on. Like, the
yeah,
only
where they
stuff
rip
that...
off the serpentine gag as well.
Yeah, well, oh, absolutely.
Like, not just that they're shooting the guys running in a zigzag, but, like, they actually make it a point to yell the strategy of don't move in a straight line.
Well, yeah.
And it's like, so if you saw The In-Laws, why didn't you make your movie more like The In-Laws?
Well, yeah, and the only stuff that's working during this point is you got Charles Grodin's Harrison, who's listening in on this thing, and is basically, it's like, look, you need to get out of there, we can still pass this off as an accident or a misunderstanding or something, at this point, where he's just, you know, going into contingency plans for, please, love of God, don't let this American helicopter get shot down in the middle of this country, we will have so many questions we need to answer that we cannot at this point in time. And his frustration, again, Grodin to the rescue, he is the only thing at this point that is working to keep this movie afloat.
It sort of pays off, because then we get like that sort of three-way or three telephone conversation that he's basically carrying that scene himself, and culminates with the president yelling at him, where it's like, no sir, I did not order men to fire onto Americans in the desert. Who told you that? The Secretary of State, huh? Well, how would he even know?
exactly.
And, like, again, you know, I would so much rather watch a movie centered on the Jim Harrison character, because at least that's fun and understands what it aims to do. But yeah, we end up getting, like, a weirdly non-climactic gunfight between Chuck, Lyle, and then Shira, who has found them in the desert. And then the helicopters just fly away. And then we basically get, like, more or less the montage transportation of them suddenly from the middle of the desert being hunted down by the CIA and everyone wanting them dead to them revealing they have the map. So I guess that gives them safe passage somehow. But they broker a deal with the CIA where they can come home. They are protected. They won't tell anyone about what happened. And in exchange for that, the CIA also has to help them promote their album.
Well, not only that, but yes, the corrupt dictator that's in control of Ishtar is to be brought down. The government agrees to this. But yes, they end up going, you know, they agree that they have to produce and promote this record and tour with the two of them going there. And then we get them performing the show in front of a military army, Harrison, and a few American generals who have been brought in to sort of see what the hell the CIA has gotten them into.
Yeah, because Harrison has, like, come up with this story about how these guys are going to be crucial to, like, you know, crucial to some kind of operation that requires the military to have a presence at their lounge act.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the stock joke of, you know, even going back to, like, the Thin Man and the idea of, you know, the cops being the, you know, the serving staff at the dinner party. Here you get all the theater goers are servicemen who are being ordered to applaud. That isn't what's funny about this scene. This is actually, like, one of the only sequences where I think the delivery through and through is genuinely very funny.
It is, but it builds to a moment of ridiculousness where we're supposed to accept that Shira is actually moved by their ridiculous love song and that we're actually invested in what she thinks about any of this anyway. And believe me,
she loves both of them. It's also carried along, though, because Charles Grodin is doing the absolute perfect, you know, like, quiet desperation. As, like, yeah, he keeps cutting to the band on stage and him, like, turning to the horrified general and, like, doing that whole, you love it, right? Please say you love it. But, like, yeah, at one point he just turns and, like, they're singing the song about, like, likening, you know, love to a wardrobe. Come in, try on whatever you'd like. And then Charles Grodin just turns to the general and he's like, you know, they write their own music and lyrics.
Yeah. And that, like, again, Charles Grodin is really the only thing in this film that works. He's the only one who's able to sell it.
It's just, and laughing hard at that part, like, this should not be the only moment in a big screen, big budget comedy where that happens.
No.
But yeah, and then the problem is, though, also, you know, it caps off with them singing the song they were writing at the beginning. Telling the truth can be a dangerous business.
Yeah.
And, you know, being slightly off key and slightly off tempo and, like, holding the mic for the other to sing while the other guy just clearly doesn't notice the cue. The problem is that they finish the song and then it cuts to them having their own, like, Simon and Garfunkel-esque poster on a board wall, and then the credits roll.
The thing is, I actually do like the symmetry, because the film opens up with them staring up at a wall where, yeah, they've got, you know, Simon and Garfunkel, the talking heads, and all this. And when we get to the end, we see it's that same wall. You know, we've got Peter Gabriel's So album up there, and we see, yes, it's their album, but it's been, like, you know, deeply discounted down to, like, 50% off.
Yeah, I love the final detail of new sale price.
Exactly, which admittedly was kind of funny, but by that point I just did not care. Like, this, by the time I got this at the end of this movie, like, I'm gonna straight up say this is one of the worst films we've covered on this show. I mean, it's not the worst the VIPs is still possibly the most offensive one we've come across. Heart Condition is terrible but fascinating, and I think by you know, arguably is more ineptly made but kind of brilliantly so.
Yeah.
This film just sits there and is just, It's miserable. It's overlong. I get, you know, at a certain point, I'm just getting annoyed by Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman's shtick. Well, at this point,
there's an old wisdom to the effect of in life, one should choose only what's masterpiece level good or astonishingly bad. And like, that's sort of the irony of this film, because on a technical level, on sort of like a constructive and performance level, it's not the worst film we've ever seen. It's kind of far from it, but it is one of the most aggravating and frustrating, simply because, like, just again, it's that central question of what was it that May, Beatty, and everybody saw in this film? What aspect, at what stage, that they were like, no, this is something worth burning our bridges with one another, possibly jeopardizing all of our careers and losing a ton of other people's money? Like, why? It feels very much like a Moby Dick project, but it doesn't seem that there's anything like personal or any necessary amount of personal vision, or, you know, that one performance that truly brings a character, you know, off of the page and, you know, into the canon. None of that happens here. None of the film is interested in creating those moments. So why? $50 million in like 6 months in a war zone so you can retread the movies you watched when you were growing up? I don't get it.
And that's the thing. I honestly don't think there is a thing to get. I think, but looking at the history here, in this instance, I mean, with the full acknowledgement that I don't know Elaine May's, I haven't read an autobiography. I'm not super well versed in the rest of her career overall, in this instance, but I get the sense that probably the idea was supposed to be, oh, this will be a lark. We'll go out, we'll have a good time, we'll, you know, improvise some, you know, material and work on stuff like this while we go out there, and we'll just have a fun time. But again, you know, that's one thing to do when you're doing it on a small scale and you're just working with your buddies, and you can afford to be perfectionist and shoot for 6 months when you're making a film that's set in New York or Chicago or wherever the hell you're going to set it there, and you're just using a few small sets. When you go this big and you go this grand, like, you have to have a level of control and a level of understanding and a very military precision in some ways to go in, do the job, and get the hell out in this instance. And nothing indicates that anybody in this case had that or that approach to this film. Like, there's just such an absolute mismatch. And again, it's
one of
these things.
Well, they took Kubrick's work ethic and his approach to editing and sort of perfectionism, without remembering that Kubrick is a very thematic filmmaker. And, you know, there's sort of the idea that, you know, with great work, the idea that, well, that was a brutal shoot, but you can see it all there on the screen. You know, there's no Apocalypse Now style statement to be found within Ishtar. There's nothing so formally or narratively audacious to justify, like, this becoming what it becomes. And the problem is, it's like, you know, there's never going to be that redemptive moment, because I think the further and further over budget a project becomes, it's like, well, this needs to make it big, like, this needs to be of a certain level of import. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you shoot another 120 hours of footage. All you're going to be left with is Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman mucking around in a desert, because that's what Bob and Bing did.
Well, exactly. And again, coming back to it, I mean, the thing with the Bing Crosby and Bob Hope films to remember is that Bob Hope was a comedian and Bing Crosby was a musician by trade. This is what their job was. Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman were not innately comedians in this instance here. If, you know, Dan Aykroyd, you know, in the 1980s wanted to go ahead and update the Bing Crosby and Bob Hope films, you know, he probably is going to find, you know, team him with somebody where that makes sense. Hell, Paul Simon would have probably been a better fit for that kind of combination as well in this instance there. Like, I don't, like, think this is just the thing when, particularly given that era of comedy there, why these people? Why would you go with the two stars, not knowing for being, you know, innately comedic figures to headline a comedy of this scale and this size?
Well, yeah, like, it's something frustratingly generic, right? And, like, people criticized, you know, some Paul Thomas Anderson films, The Master and Phantom Thread, as, you know, because for as beautifully composed as the films are, you know, there's something sort of, I guess maybe too narrow on a thematic or sort of plot level. People sometimes criticize those films as, like, sort of having an emptiness at the center. This is a film that has an emptiness at the center, and it does absolutely nothing that sort of makes it more palatable. If you look at any register of this film, there is a frustrating emptiness.
Well, and that's the big difference, though. At least when Paul Thomas Anderson and Daniel Day-Lewis sit down to make a movie together, you know that these are two individuals who are taking their craft very seriously, whether you like the end result or not at the end of the day.
It's not that nobody was taking Ishtar seriously. It's just that nobody knew how to do what they thought they were going to do.
But I would say, based on everything we know about the production of this film, this is also a case where we have three people looking out for number one. Yeah. And that means three entirely separate things to one another. And at the end of the day, like, particularly when you are stars of a certain stature and you're all having your big competition about who's the alpha dog on the making of this thing here. I mean, I don't care. You don't watch a Paul Thomas Anderson film and get the sense that, yep, those guys were really going at it on this one, or they were really combating over what this film was. Everybody was at least on the same vision making that movie. You worked on a Kubrick movie. By God, you knew you're making a Kubrick movie. Follow through here. Nobody on this thing had the ability, seemingly, to park their ego and accept that either they weren't the one in control or that they needed to at least trust the other people involved in this instance there. And, you know, I have very little sympathy when you have, you know, that going on at such a scale with so much money, because you just know that as miserable as the shoot was for them, just think about the poor crew working on this thing.
Yeah.
Because I just, like, I can imagine every day was like, what the hell are we going to be encountering next?
Yeah, they actually made a very interesting documentary about that. It was called The Last Movie.
There we go. Exactly. So
speaking of films that failed due to ego and largesse and probably a bunch of cocaine as well.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't know.
That one, the very least, I mean, whatever else. Yeah.
Like, I guess the thing about Ishtar is maybe some of the opening framing was to signal that this is a film I think I certainly tried to approach in good faith. And again, you know, as we'll get into in the segment to follow, there are areas where if it doesn't work, you can at least see where it begins to start working. You know, and like I rarely ever sit down and watch a film and say, oh man, this is going to suck. I can't wait to dunk on it. Because if there's anything I've learned across doing the show for so long, it's that Dave is very good at, you know, sort of helping you reappreciate things in ways you may not have the first time. I don't think there's anything you'll see in Ishtar in 2021 that... we'll give it a sizably elevated understanding than audiences would have had in 1987. And if that's the case, I don't know if I can really recommend anyone going out of their way to see this, other than to know what it is.
Well, yeah, and honestly, I would not recommend that anybody see this. I don't get the critical reevaluation. I don't get the people turning around and saying, you know, it was actually pretty funny, because it's not. Like, it really is. Like, this is the sort of film where, I mean, if people turn around and said Ishtar was really funny in 1987 and came back around and said, oh no, this thing is awful, I would believe maybe that version of the story that happened. Any version where people turn around and say, no, Ishtar was kind of a misunderstood good movie. No, it isn't. It's bad. Let it rot in the past, and we will try and salvage at least the few decent things in the hits and pits segment for you.
Yes, the desert is full of broken heroes on a last chance power drive. But yeah, I mean, my God, this movie. I'm weirdly disappointed because it's not even as spectacularly as bad as you would want it to be. But speaking of which, though, I guess we should pivot to our closing segment where we decide to drill it down to the little things, the Elaine May-esque small details, and talk for way too long as we celebrate and condemn the little things. It's hits and pits. So, Dave, as our resident guy who goes first for this segment, what is your first hit, if you have any, for Elaine May's Ishtar?
There is one scene that does not feature Charles Grodin that is legitimately hilarious in this film. And that is Matt Frewer as a CIA agent on the ground. Because there's a moment when they're in, I guess it's a bazaar is where they're supposed to be. And Chuck and Lyle are getting followed around by the CIA agents. And there's a few decent visual gags where there's like a whole army that's clearly supposed to be tailing them very obviously. And yet somehow Chuck and Lyle still don't pick up on it. But the gag involves Frewer there speaking to another associate beside him. It's like, I just spotted, you know, this faction over here. Oh, the guys in the Bermuda shorts? It's like, no, the guys in the Bermuda shorts are the Russians. That's not them in this instance. Yeah.
And the guys in Hawaiian shirts, they're Turkish intelligence. Well, who are the guys in the polo shirts? Nobody. Those are tourists.
Exactly. And Matt Frewer, I love his deadpan delivery of these lines. Like, he is taking this 100% seriously, like he's an actual CIA agent. And it is gut-bustingly funny for a minute and a half of screen time watching the absurdity of the dialogue as he breaks down all the different factions that are apparently involved in this. And it makes me, again, wish that this was a movie about, you know, Charles Grodin and Matt Frewer as his CIA man on the ground trying to comprehend an increasingly ludicrous situation that does not make sense from their perspective at all. But that was one of the few scenes in this film that made me legitimately laugh in this instance here. So again, salute to you, Matt Frewer, and salute to that scene. Andrew, what about you? What would you say is your first hit in this instance?
I think I have to give it to Charles Grodin, because if you're watching a comedy, you should probably celebrate the one guy that makes you laugh more than anybody else. Again, echoing largely your same points. But, you know, Grodin, he understood the assignment, as they say. But, you know, he does it well. And again, like, I guess I wonder whether or not they can achieve what they set out to achieve, where they're making a wacky screwball film that also has, like, impassioned speeches about the need for few to die so many can thrive. Whereas, like, the scenes with Grodin, that shows the tier where if the film does work anywhere, it works here. And, again, sort of the shame of it is you realize that you could have made more of the movie in this register, and it certainly wouldn't have suffered for it. Dave, do you have a second hit?
I just want to give it to Carol Kane, who really deserves better than this. Like, I mean, particularly even in the 1980s, she had already been a great working actor for a long time leading up to this. She gets an absolutely thankless role in this movie, and we've seen how good she can be in things like My Blue Heaven. So, honestly, what the hell? Why was she wasted in this nothing role as Chuck's girlfriend in this movie early on? Like, come on, if you got Carol Kane, make Carol Kane worth her showing up on set for. All right, folks.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. There's a lot of misapplication on display. Just trying to think on a positive note. I guess I would probably give my second hit to May and also to Paul Williams for the songs in the film. As we've talked before, like, you know, and earlier in the episode, it is difficult to make something that's the right kind of bad, but at the same time, you know, there is something about the songs that, while they're not pleasant, there is something kind of charmingly right kind of bad about them. And again, Dangerous Business is the stupidest song in the world, but it will get stuck in your head. And, you know, it's the songs themselves also lend well to those early scenes of Chuck and Lyle, like, just back and forthing, trying to hash out the most obvious, like, facile rhymes you can think of. But, you know, the end result is Warren Beatty and Justin Hoffman singing slightly out of step with each other about how people point and laugh when you cry in public. And then admonishing, don't be a baby, only babies should cry. It's like, what? This is just a deeply weird thing to be encountering. And, you know, that's the thing. This is a film that it's not weird enough to be what it can be. It's not funny enough to justify calling itself a comedy. It doesn't have meaningful action. It doesn't have any meaningful or significant, like, political subtext or anything. It has little glimpses of it here and there. And it's like, just any one of those committing to it would have made for a much stronger film. And with that, though, we tie a bow on it by pivoting to the inverse, The Pits. And Dave, I know for all we have spoken at length about this film's myriad flaws, what is the first one that you would like to cast some blame on?
Warren Beatty as both producer and star of this movie. This film should not have happened, straight up here. And putting aside the absolute condescending manner in which he apparently saw what this picture was, which is just a straight up insult to Elaine May in this instance, you know, he went along with these things, and a lot of the decisions he were made on this film either were fueled by his ego more than anything else. His performance is terrible, and that's even the least of his sins in the making of this movie here. Basically, bad-mouthing and sabotaging Elaine May after making promises to protect her, getting into constant fights with her, you know, then refusing to fire her because you're afraid of how it's going to impact you at the end of the day and how people perceive you. I think that is very much telling of the sort of egocentric Hollywood mindset that was sort of driving him in this instance. And while that's not to all let Dustin Hoffman or Elaine May or Vittorio Storaro off the hook for anything they've done, Warren Beatty, above and beyond anything, is responsible, as far as I'm concerned, for this mess this instance, and deserves it.
Regardless of whether it was, you know, a patronizing gesture to begin with, for all of his efforts, this movie certainly didn't do Elaine May any favors, right? And I believe it's not until The Birdcage that she gets credited work. And, you know, that in Primary Colors coming out, which is unfortunate, you know. It's just, I guess the other thing, like, just to tack on with Beatty is it's like, coming off of Reds, coming off of Oscar wins, coming off, like, art house and, you know, sort of tentpole American films, and then deciding that this is the project that you are going to settle your own and others' reputations on. Like, I don't get it. I guess, I'd be genuinely curious to, like, hear an interview with Warren Beatty where it's like, in your mind, ideally, how did you see this playing out, given the script that you had and the movie it turned into? But, I mean, at the same time, I need to put, I think, a little bit of blame interchangeably between Elaine May, Richard Cerincione, William Reynolds, and Stephen Rotter, all four apparently had a hand in the editing of this film. And as we've said before, if you have more than two editors on a film, that's usually a sign that something worrisome has happened, because most films only need one. And again, just the idea of, like, okay, I get that it's a challenge to cut down 110 hours of raw footage into two. I don't understand how different the rest of the footage could be. I don't, like, so much of the post-production of this film just does not seem to have needed to happen at all. And it seems like, by all accounts, the editing was, again, sort of a self-inflicted wound, where it's like, I don't think there's any inherent reason with this material why it should take the threat of legal action from the studio to finally get May to turn in a cut that she's decided she's happy with. And the heartbreaking part is that's the film that you end up getting. Because again, we've said before that lots of films can overrun, but shrewd editing can really transform a film. Going back to Annie Hall, like what they shot was very different from the ultimate film that it becomes. That does not happen here. More importantly, the only interesting things that this film does in editing, it forgets how to do those things after the 20-minute mark.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing, and I would be very curious to see who is responsible for what in this film. Like, part of me wonders whether, like, the opening section was the only one that May really had a chance to edit her way, more than anything else. But that's me, you know, taking a pure guesswork at this point. Like, it
that
really
does make
is...
sense, because it is a tonally distinct chunk of the film.
Yeah, and it's probably, and again, it's the only section of this movie where everybody seems to be reasonably comfortable with what they're doing, and goes to show that this probably, you should have just abandoned the road movie film and just made it a film about a couple of guys writing terrible songs in New York. But
or at least shoot it on a soundstage, man. Save yourself the hassle. Do you have a second hit specific to name for Ishtar?
Dave Grusin's score, like the music by Paul Williams is great, but the score to this film is just kind of generic and forgettable. Like, I honestly don't, like, it adds nothing to the film and really just sort of indulges in some of the sort of cliches that we've come to expect for films set in areas like Morocco in this instance there. It's not distinctive. It's not interesting. I mean, it would be what nice if there was something distinct about it. And when it goes into the sort of, and again, I say this is the guy who likes synthesizers on scores when they're done well. The synthesizer music in this film is, when it goes that road, is not good whatsoever.
Well, yeah.
It just,
I mean, they're not unilateral, right? For every main organ line on Dire Straits' Walk of Life, there is the secondary organ line on Dire Straits' Walk of Life. yeah, this is a pretty unremarkable score. And what you get is the fairly conventional, like, Middle Eastern leitmotifs.
Yeah, exactly. So, honestly, that would be my second one. What about you? Do you have anything that we really need to lambast at this point?
I guess just the unholy trinity, yeah. I guess, at the center of this film. Because I feel like May's script does not... It's not funny enough on its own to really rise to any notable level, but it also isn't written in a way that it clearly seems like it's giving the actors space to, like, style on or add their own flair or sort of, you know, improvise or create those spaces for comedy through performance. But at the same time, it doesn't seem like Beatty and Hoffman, though they have moments of chemistry and a few funny lines apiece themselves, they don't seem like the actors that have the comic chops where they can do that. And, like, you know, we've seen Bulletproof Monk. There were at least scenes where Sean William Scott and Chow Yun-Fat are clearly riffing on set, and it's funny and organic and works. And for some reason, I don't see Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty being able to do that with this script. So you're kind of locked into a stalemate there, where there's just, if that's the state of affairs, that brings us back to the question of, why did these three people want to make a film together, and why did it end up becoming this film? And having watched it, having talked about it for 9 minutes, I still don't know if I'm any closer to the answer. And maybe that's the real legacy of Ishtar, the film nobody asked for except the people who made it, and the film nobody saw except people who host film podcasts.
Precisely. So, yeah, as much as I would like to say that it's very difficult, if not impossible, to get your hands on Ishtar, it's actually reasonably decent and easy to get your hands on it. There's a Blu-ray out there. I mercifully don't own it. I rented this off of YouTube instead. So if you're a glutton for punishment, by all means, seek it out. Godspeed. That's really what I've got.
You can do a lot better with your time and a few things worse. And they can put that on the cover for when it gets a Criterion release.
God, yeah.
Speaking of which, though, Dave, you should tell everyone where we're going next time. Hopefully more Criterion tier than Bargain Bin tier, because so far we're batting like 500 for the new year, and I like it when we watch good movies.
Yeah, so in this instance here, we're actually going to be following Carol Kane to a film from 1975, which, funny enough, and I did not realize it when I selected this to be the follow-up film, is based on an article that was co-written by P.F. Klug, the author of Eddie and the Cruisers, and yep. That is, we're going to be taking a look at Sidney Lumet's Dog Day Afternoon, starring Al Pacino, John Cazale, as well as Charles Durning, a young Lance Henriksen, and yes, Carol Kane in this instance. And,
oh man, I haven't seen this movie in years, but congratulations, Dave, you understood the assignment. So we're gonna we'll trade our whoas for Atticas 1 week only, and we'll probably end up having to on the air count up all the times Al Pacino has been on our show to date.
Yes.
That being said, I am looking very forward to it. And if you like movies that don't just make us complain and try to remember not to curse, stay tuned. Hopefully you'll enjoy it too. In the meantime, though, Dave, where can people get in touch with you on social media?
Why, you can find me at 24 Panels. Always happy to have a civil conversation. What about you, Andrew?
You can find me over at FilmStripper or by emailing the show at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to rate and review us, head on over to iTunes. 5-star reviews help move us up the featured charts. But more importantly, it's where you can leave us some feedback. What do you like? What do you hate? What do you want us to do more? And what do you want us to never, ever, ever do again other than talk about Ishtar? Let us know. Because as we head into the new year, onwards and upwards, our goal remains the same, and that's to bring you a show that you want to listen to.
Indeed. And with that, Andrew, are there any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Why, yes, David, there are. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Afterwards, Monotony's going to go interview Matt Frewer and ask him some questions about Psi Factor. Bye.